endured yet. Something. Then there's things of a lot of the time Rebel Six will have these kind of outrageous falsettos he's then putting through it. So yeah, it's kind of So I mean, yeah, again with this notion of the voice being the new synth, it is like, you know, someone finding what Rebel Six has done. He's found the new modern day equivalent of a new synth sound. You know, sort of like the Joey Belt from it.
It's interesting because when you hear it in pop music, there is something slight here about it because it's the same voice, you know, but it's on a continuum with like a history in pop and multi-tracking a single voice, or what's that thing that Beatles did where they doubled the singer's voice, automatic double, where there's the voice is smudged because it's two versions of the same thing slightly. Like, yeah, think so, but this is like it sounds like what you're describing is people taking something that is slightly new here on the normal radio and bring out this psychotic dimension, because the multiplication of the self, the vocal self, kind of, you know, it's like schizophrenia or
and we'll even going back to the ad lib we'll talk about in Frag Rap. The thing of sort of it sounds like one voice having a conversation with itself, kind of these kind of digital voices talking to themselves, and likewise you get kind of that same kind of conceptual aspect in a different way with these harmonized voices. I mean, there's a whole bunch of artists from a Jamaican trap dance collective called The Six, and they do these kind of multi-track voices in a far subtler way. Where so it's not quite so overt, you kind of have to really listen to, oh shit, they're actually layered vocals, and that is very much the quality of kind of almost like possession, or as you say, something a bit more schizophrenic, where it's one, but you know, like in The Exorcist, thing of the girl in The Exorcist, I think she speaks with kind of several layered voices, so you know, it's just kind of that it does bring that kind of thing to mind, yeah.
So there's a slight glitch in your book's argument, in that, you know, the subtitle says how drill, trap and bashment in music new again, and you know, you're talking about vocal psychedelia, but one of those three genres doesn't have a whole lot going on in terms of vocal, so it's like drill. UK drill does not really use your auto-tune.
No auto-tune, no, nothing.
There's interesting things about the vocals and the lyrics, but they're not related to this technological mutation of the voice. So well, tell us what is it exciting about UK drill. Why was that part of your revolution?
Well, I think the interesting thing about drill is it's an innovation probably in an older mode. So I think the thing with drill is it's innovation. The central one is rhythmic. It's sort of found these new kind of drum patterns. I mean, I think it's probably, arguably, it's sort of supplanted jungle. It's the kind of the most rhythmically complex or sophisticated populist music the Anglosphere produced. I mean, so there's sort of some Bulgarian folk music that's all clever rhythmically. But drill, I think, it's probably sort of overtaken jungle. It's sort of basically it's defined by these very intricate, asymmetric, very kind of jittery kind of 808 rhythms played at 140. And you can sort of see drill. Because drill kind of it's this thing of it's almost like as if trap was haunted by the folk memory of jungle. So the rhythms are fairly jungly at times. Or the bass lines, for example, they're like the kind of the dread bass that you would have had in jungle. This reverse bass sound kind of amped up, you know. So the basses become completely elastic and springing around and all that. Yeah, so it's sort of it's innovation, but in arguably a kind of an older mode of it.
And you bring up jungle, but it's not dances. It's not like people aren't going to clubs dancing these tracks, or are they?
No, well, no. I mean, the thing in the UK is we have slight issues with the police, and the police have basically shut down a lot of black music, like clubs and stuff like that. So it's quite difficult for London to produce the dance music. Because it's just sort of the laws clamping down on it. No, drill. I mean, drill kind of betrays.
Where does it live then? As a music, it's not got a DJing out club dimension. What are the spaces in which drill circulates?
It's sort of distributed mainly on YouTube. People have put up videos. And yeah, you know, you sort of, it's people playing it out their cars, playing it out their phones. It become, you know, kind of over Snapchat. You kind of have all this culture of, you know, things being leaked on Snapchat and all that. So it exists, yeah, that sort of exists maybe in a bit more of a kind of a personal thing rather than a, yeah, something to dance to at a club or a party.
And the sense they got from it, from what I've heard, is, you know, there are really bizarre tracks, but a lot of it seems to work in a kind of cumulative way. Like, it's sort of like this sort of, there's an ambient dimension to it, I think. It's interesting that you, as you say, there are these really interesting broken rhythms, but they're not really actually pulling at your body much. And a lot of the effect of the sound is these sort of eerie electronic sounds, what sways the texture, and then the pianos is a motif you talk about. Like yeah, I think you can connect it to Chopin.
Yeah.
So, do the people just use it as a sort of everyday life surround sound thing? They live with it.
Well, I mean, there are some kids around the corner from me selling drugs, and they just always stand around when they're selling drugs, playing drill out their phones. So yeah, it's sort of yeah, I think it very much can be enjoyed in a kind of a non-physical, non-party way. I mean, sort of emotionally, it's really bleak. You know, these pianos are tragic, hence the kind of a broken connection.
Well, they're not always tragic. What about happy hardcore? You know, pianos in Italo house and happy hardcore.
No, that's the thing. So I mean, that's the thing. Sort of drills taken. I mean, that's the thing. Kind of quite the piano just. Watching what's happened to the piano going from hardcore to drill. You've got, you know, the drills in the piano's in hardcore with these kind of super optimistic, shiny, very crisp sounding as well. And then, you know, in drill they become these kind of murky, sludgy, despairing things.
It is extremely bleak sounding music, and there's tremendous, you know, creativity with the word. The words, actually, like lyrically, you go very deep into analysing the not the language and the intonation. Like you can compare some MCs' rhythms to Mary Poppins, and you know, and the funny use of language, like quaint or archaic terms, or sort of kind of poncy posh terms that pop up in the middle of lyrics that are otherwise about pretty gritty, gnarly. Street stuff, you know, gang fights in Tulse Hill and Kennington and places like that. But yeah, the overall movie, even though there is this sort of grinny kind of playfulness within it, the overall effect of it, it speaks, I think, again, to quite depressing social state of things.
Maybe it's sort of to be a bit cliche about it, but you know, in the UK, we've had sort of now 10 years of austerity, you know, with sort of Brexit. So there's sort of this kind of quite bleak. There's a bleakness in the zeitgeist as it is anyway. And so I think, you know, drill, just on a very basic level, the tragedy of modern Britain is manifest sonically in the music.
One of the things that's very striking about Neon Screams is it comes up again and again. Well, talking of drill, you know, you have, what's the outfit called? Sparta?
You've got Harlem Spartan.
Yeah.
Drill collection. Yeah.
And that's a nod to film 300, isn't it?
I presume so, yeah. I mean, they talk about being 300, so yeah, it is.
So, there's this sort of thing, you know, Mark Fisher talks about pulp modernism. This is more like pulp mythology or pulp mysticism. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's influenced by, you know, TV, Hollywood, fantasy and dystopian films and superhero stuff. A lot of stuff that's kind of mythopoeic, is that the word? But, you know, fantasies of heroism or language of heroism, superheroism, and of saga and destiny and glory and legend, you know. This is how these people see their lives, and it suffuses into their imagination. And I think you're very alert to that, whether it's the dancehall people who are using a lot of kind of, you know, pre-modern sort of imagery to describe themselves, and for the drill people who, you know, join on these kind of films like Spartan 300, how to bring out that sort of dimension a bit. Talk a bit about how that.
Yeah, well, so you've got Harlem Spartans. You also then need to make this guy Tommy Lee Sparta again, probably.
Oh, yeah.
So you know you've got Sparta's idea cropped up throughout. Then you've got things of like Vibes Cartel kind of leads this collective of artists, sometimes called Gaza, but also called the Portmore Empire. Portmore, this area where he comes from. So as you say, you do have this whole sort of quasi mythological edge to it. And that's something that's not only kind of lyrical, or it's not only in kind of artist names and all that, it's sort of the sonically as well. You have this kind of what I call digital pastoralism, or digi pastoralism, where you've got kind of folk revival-y flutes in loads of instrumentals, kind of gamelan bells, kind of what you call world music and kind of textures, all kind of digitized to a certain extent, but existing in this music as well. So as you say, it's sort of this whole kind of pre-modern edge to it. And I think again, I mean, that's, you do tend to get that whenever psychedelia kind of manifests itself. You know, the thing of obviously in the 60s you had all that kind of folky stuff and all that pastoral stuff, and then even say with rave, just on a simple level, everyone being out in a field and they do, you know, at these raves. So it's a kind of does seem to be this recurring feature of psychedelia.
But in as you say, in this kind of music, it's kind of it's kind of like digital, in a weird sort of way, denatured imagery of the pastoral. And then you have these sort of kind of fake, kitschy world music elements.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's this economist called Noah Smith, and he recently wrote about kind of a world after cyberpunk. So he's basically, his theory, which I was thinking along the same lines as well, writing the book, of kind of we've arrived in many ways at cyberpunk, which is maybe arguably our sort of last cohesive notion of the future, the cyberpunk. And, you know, if you think mass surveillance, hacktivism, that group Anonymous who wear the Guy Fawkes masks and do the hacking, that, you know, Trump is like the character of a robot. So we've sort of arrived at cyberpunk, and he was wondering what our next futurism will be. He sort of suggested this idea he called solarpunk, which I guess is kind of futuristic buildings covered in flowers and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, our pervading notion of the future at the moment is one of environmental catastrophe, you know, given climate change and all that. So there is sort of a connection to be made there with this notion of how the future and the sort of our environment, the natural world, integrate with one another. It's sort of, you can see manifest in the music and this sort of digi pastoralism thing, you know, you think kind of popular games like Minecraft, Red Dead Redemption, you know, like kind of fantasy stuff like the Game of Thrones, sort of all CGI creating fields and all that. So it's this kind of pervasive thing in the zeitgeist.
Are video games very important, you think, with all these kinds of music? Is this sort of, does it feed into how people see themselves and the kind of fantasies they have about themselves?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. It's sort of hard to say, really, because, you know, say with a grind, with sort of literal video game samples, and I think kind of people naming themselves after game characters, you probably get a bit less of that. One thing is, in dancehall, you have a lot of these kind of orchestral arrangements, you know, kind of orchestra, like strings and stuff. And I suppose where they could have come from is, I think you get a lot of that in kind of Call of Duty, is kind of military orchestral soundscape. So perhaps that might fed into it. You also have this thing of people kind of uploading dodgy artwork where they just sort of grab stuff, unlicensed things of, you know, video game characters, and they Photoshop their face on them and all that. So it does sort of feed at least into the visual aspects of a lot of it.
See, you grew up in South London surrounded by this music, but you're white. I think your background is kind of middle class, right?
Yeah.
Do you ever, what kind of self-reflexivity do you bring to this question of a white middle class person writing about these street sounds that in a certain sense are the cultural property of people not like you?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, I suppose that's probably a question for other people to answer or to have their own opinion on. I mean, the thing in the end of the day, I'm celebrating this music. I don't particularly think the way I'm analysing it particularly conforms to negative tropes about black people. I mean, say, for example, look, pretty much all the journalism about drill has been sort of, oh, it's sort of all terrible gangs and crime and blah, 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 blah. Whereas I'm talking about it in terms of it being science fiction or it being a bit psychedelic, you know. So it's sort of, if anything, I'd say the way I'm talking about it removes it from maybe a bit more harmful notions of blackness, or at least more, you know, more comprehensive. These artists are people. They don't just exist as an expression of one particular social situation, but they're people who like all sorts of stuff. So I'd like to think that the way I'm writing about it is actually a positive thing, but I'm sure that other people.
But I mean, there's hardly, I haven't read any writing, I don't think, about UK drill that talks about it as a musically innovative form. It's almost entirely, you know, sensationalistic and alarmist a lot of the time, certainly in mainstream media. So the fact that you're saying there are all these things going on in drill music that are interesting musically, and you should respond to it primarily as a well, not primarily, but certainly that's something you have to deal with, is the sonic innovations and strangeness of it, as well as, you know, I mean, it is informed by the social surroundings, and there's no way around it, and it comes through in the lyrics and then the names, the groups name themselves after, which often have gang affiliations in, right? Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. That's just the reality. But you're claiming it's, you know, the best thing to come out of Britain in the 2010s for sonic reasons, not just because of what it reflects.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, this is your life, and you've lived with this music since before, right? Hey, Garage,
the
first thing you can remember, right?
Yeah, sort of. Garage, you know, probably would have been in the charts when I was a kid. Also, my dad reminded me, you know, not that long ago, that when I was growing up upstairs, the bloke ran a sound system. So, you know, probably kind of had a lover's rock and dance hall and all that. And kind of just as a kind of in the air, you know, part of the ambience. And, you know, if you're growing up and you're going to school and you listen to what the other kids listen to and all that. And in the UK, you know, we've got we have a lot of Jamaicans, sort of first and second generation Jamaican immigrants or Caribbean immigrants. So dancehall is this huge thing in the UK. Probably in London, I'd say dancehall is probably bigger than rap, you know, bigger than American rap.
Right.
And so you can sort of, arguably, the kind of emphasis I place on the music is reflects that.
Well, you're like a product of, you know, this has been going on since at least the 80s, which is like just kind of multiracial music tradition where, you know, all these things from, I don't know, fast reggae chat in the 80s to bleep techno in the early 90s and jungle and UK garage, they're all like sort of only in the UK combinations of things that come, you know, from outside the UK, usually America and Jamaica, and then in more recent years from Africa, from particularly Lagos, right? And one thing you don't seem that keen on Afrobeats, which is for a lot of people would be a big part of this story. So what are your, why are you less keen? There's a couple of figures you really rate, right?
So there's this guy, Terry G, who kind of would have been around, again, the turn of the 2010s, so sort of same time as Cartel. So I think he has a few tracks that are kind of really preempt this vocal psychedelia, so he's very good. I like the occasional Afrobeat thing. I mean, it's sort of, you know, I think a lot of it sort of works as pop, very good pop, you know, the melodies are fun and it's good if you want to sing about being in love with some girl or whatever it is. Probably kind of, yeah, you're not quite getting that kind of, I don't know, to me it doesn't quite have that future shock or that psychedelic thing, but I think the other music I talk about in the book.
Sort of quite, a lot of it's quite sort of pop, very melodic, sort of good
times. Yeah, it can be a bit cloying. Yeah, I mean, but also just say the thing and say what they do with auto-tune, or say what they do with the voice. Arguably, you're not quite getting the innovation that you'd be getting, say, in Jamaican music or Caribbean music.
So what would you say, you know, I think one of your sort of limits or things you're going against is this argument that people make, but I'll make it even though I don't agree with it, you know, which is this idea of auto-tune and related technologies as being homogenizing and standardizing technologies. And you're saying, actually, no, it's releasing individuality, and it's a vessel for extreme eccentric.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's sort of it catalyzes it, sort of incentivizes it. Yeah, so I mean, the thing is, sort of, you know, the kind of stereotype of it all kind of sounding like Stephen Hawking or something, it's sort of just not true. I mean, say the kind of the difference between, you know, an artist like Chronic Law and Tommy Lee Spartan, you know, start very different. I mean, I don't know, it's sort of, I mean, what we could do, in fact, is we could play a few examples of just how diverse.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I think this is a kind of basic, you know, 2000 auto-tune for the most part. I mean, he's doing quite a gruff voice, and it gives it a bit of a tubular quality to it. So that's the kind of basic thing. And then, so you've got either, you know, something like this, the complete opposite end, where that was hard, this is kind of much more fragile, where that was very kind of angular sounding, this is very kind of sinuous sounding. And then we've got this kind of thing, you know, taking that nasal, the way the auto-tuner interacts with the nasal voice to an extreme. And this is a very strange thing. I think this is kind of, we might see a bit more of this in the next year or two from Jamaica, kind of a bubbly voice type thing. And this one, yeah, I think again, another one of that weird kind of strange bubbly voice sound. And this is probably a good one. If you think the way how those vocals were kind of stuttering and scratching, how actually auto-tune is still quite unwieldy. It hasn't kind of surrendered to artists being in full control. That was just a good example of the vibrato you can get with it. Yeah, this is, I mean, I don't even know what the fuck this is. It's so kind of searing, you know, it sounds so searing. And then here's the kind of, the falsetto thing, the weird thing, you know, a lot of the times these very simple things that actually get great effect. So the thing is, going, you wouldn't, why would a kind of a silly falsetto get such a good noise? But actually, I think, as a lot of Jamaican artists have found out, it does get a very good one.
One thing I think that is worth emphasizing is that auto-tune, the way these people use it, is not something that is added on later by a producer or an engineer. Most of them are working with the effect and other effects as well in real time. So they're actually responding to it, pushing it further. And so I think one of the analogies you use in the book is you say it's more like, the comparison is less with, I don't know, how techno or house producers worked, or, you know, or Craft or whatever, but something more like Jimi Hendrix actually is a better analogy. For how these people like Future, Young Thug, you know, they're improvising, aren't they? They're in a symbiotic relationship with the technology, expressing themselves in this really freakily individualistic way in an actual musical moment, which is quite different.
Well, I mean, it's sort of telling, you know, the kind of term ad-lib being a buzzword in rap at the moment, because that does suggest it's off the top of your head, spontaneous. And so, yeah, so you could sort of argue with auto-tune, you're reintroducing this sort of these things of improvisation and spontaneity and all that back into the making of digital music, which is, you know, before when you had sequencers or you kind of, you know, you had your digital audio worktop, they call it workstation, where you kind of got blobs of sound just stretching out and arranging. It's all very kind of considered, whereas this stuff's coming off the top of your head. I mean, also, the thing in terms of artists, using it in real time. The thing of, you know, the thing of the artists adapting their voices to get the most potently futuristic sound they can out of it. So the one thing with autotune is it seems to work much more consistently or much better with kind of nasally voices and with high-pitched voices, with falsettos, that kind of thing. And so you can see, particularly in dancehall, artists really honing in on those kind of vocal performance styles to get the best effect out of autotune.
So there's a kind of extreme vocal technique as well as the technology, or the two are meshing together to create these effects.
Yeah. And the technology incentivizes artists to reach for those further and further extremes.
So we've had quite a serious discussion. I think it bears mentioning that the book is very fun to read. It's got tremendous bouncy, exciting energy about it. It's also pretty humorous. You have some quite colourful imagery pops up. It was often almost like a Viz-like element here and there. clearly you want people to, you're not lecturing people in this book, you're kind of throwing them in at the deep end of this.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean,
fun, exciting music, outrageous.
Well, I suppose the thing is sort of, I think the book, I hope that the book's enjoyable even if you have never and will never hear the music I'm talking about in it. Just the thing of it being cheeky and funny or a bit silly or a bit ridiculous, kind of gleefully pretentious, whatever it is. So just sort of the writing I want to be kind of enjoyable on its own terms.
Yeah, I mean, I think someone could read it and get a lot out of it and just have minimal exposure to the music. It's a book in a certain kind of mode, or a semi-tradition, I would put it like the I Be the Prophet mode, and examples of that in music writing history would be, I don't know, Cones, Bop Bam Boom, At the Risk of Immodesty. I think my own list out is like that. Another one would be Kojo Eshin's More Brilliant Than the Sun. One of the things, though, just to give you a last provocation, is that often by the time the book comes out, there's actually the era being mythologized is about to go through a shift. So just through the nature of how it takes to do a book and when it comes out. So what I wonder is, do you feel that the sort of innovative future generative things that you've identified in the 2010s, do you feel that they're still more further to go with them, or is there going to be, I think about dub, dub has this 5-year period, really from end of 74, the end of the decade, when it's amazing, then it just kind of ossifies a bit, and it has a afterlife in other genres, in sort of house music, remixes on the B-side, and various other areas, and they just crops up in jungle and all kinds of things. But as a sort of Jamaican form, dub has this period when it's just exploding with amazing stuff, and then it just kind of settles, and actually Jamaica itself moves on to something else, dancehall, completely different from dub. So what do you think that the things you've identified, like say with the frag rap and the mumble rap, is there still further to go with that? Or drill,
give a bit of a timeline. I'd say sort of drill, the peak of UK drill is maybe 2017. Then it's you've got Brooklyn drill now, which is derivative of UK drill, but it's sort of got slight differences. And that I think maybe sort of having its peak around at the moment. Then say with the frag rap and the mumble rap, that was probably maybe kind of 2017, 2018. Then so now the thing of trap dance, I think seems like 2020 was the golden year for that. So my personal philosophy is I want music, you kind of get a new genre every 2 or 3 years. The thing of, in your writing a lot, you talked about kind of the evolution. You'd have hardcore in the early 90s, by the mid 90s you had jungle, by the late 90s you had garage, and by the early 2000s you had grime. And I think that's the kind of rate of change that I think is healthy for music, and I think modern music's living up to that. You do this kind of 2 or 3 year turnover, of ideas. So I'm fairly happy for music to come and go and for new things to be born out. And so far, the kind of late 2010s and the early 2020s are delivering.
Well, you've certainly nailed what was exciting, I think, in these musics, broadly speaking, street sounds of the 2010s and ongoing. So you've sort of done everyone a great honest service, that sounds really boring. You've done everyone a delirious yet instructive service, pleasure, delight of this book, I think. It's a great read. It's actually quite short as well, which is always good for a music book, says the guy who regularly writes books around 600 pages long. But yeah, it's just like this burst of energy and excitement and analysis, ecstatic analysis, I think, of these music. So well done. And everyone should get Neon Screens. Do you want to explain the poetic title, or do you want to just leave it as a poem, a miniature poem?
What, the title?
Yeah.
I mean, I think I was naive in thinking it's fairly self-explanatory, but even my mum had no fucking idea what I was talking about. Neon Screams, basically, you know, the kind of the synesthesia of auto-tune to me is kind of the voice turning into light. And so that's sort of that's really what that means. I think it even happened as I was describing a track or something in the book, and the term Neon Screams, and suddenly read it and thought, oh, fuck, that's the title.
Right. Yeah. It's a great title. It captures it exactly. Yeah, the turning of the voice into light relates to what you said about dematerialization and things.
Yeah.
Have a conversation with Luke Davis where you discuss all that stuff.
Yeah.
Into the book. And so yeah, well done. And everyone go buy it.
Cheers. Thank you, Simon.
warriors.
Ons consumentenvertrouwen is niet aangetast en van personeelstekort is er ook geen sprake. Wij zijn vandaag in volle bezetting met drie, zonder stoeldans. Geen XL-versie van Cinerhuis, dus vandaag gewoon een classic met veel nieuwe plaatjes. Goedenavond en welkom. We beginnen er vandaag aan met zwetende handjes en stuiterende no-wave postpunk uit Glasgow. Dit is At Any Given Minute van Sweaty Palms.
Quelling the count of the
Any Given Minute van Sweaty Palms. Intussen zijn we al wel wat gewoon van het Britse Girls in Synthesis, maar bij het horen van hun nieuwste nummer Bypassing kregen we weer een geweldige adrenaline kick. Dit nummer zal ook op de nieuwe EP staan met de bijhorende tongbreker als titel Consum Rausch. Zet u schrap, dit is Bypassing van Girls in Synthesis.
Bypassing your state of mind. Extra baggage soon be left behind. Bypassing your state of mind.
het release-tempo van OC's lag ooit al hoger dan het ritme van deze Funeral Solution. Maar wat er ook gebeurt, om de zoveel tijd mogen we toch weer een nieuwe plaat verwachten. Dit was een eerste voorsmaakje van A Fall Farm, hun nieuwe plaat die deze zomer uitkomt. Uiteraard bij Castleface. Jim Blaha van The Blind Shake speelt tegenwoordig bij Green Blue en hij zet er de pas stevig in. Binnen enkele weken verschijnt hun tweede plaat van 2022 en dit is al een eerste nummer eruit, In Lies van Green Blue.
Feest in de kantoren van Feel It Records, want we draaiden net twee nieuwe nummers van het label na elkaar. Eerst dus In Lies van Green Blue en dit was Cheddar van Spread Joy. Het grote voorbeeld van de band uit Chicago is het legendarische Wire. Midden september verschijnt Tough Baby, de tweede plaat van het Canadese collectief Crack Cloud. En dat het album er überhaupt komt, is volgens frontman Zach Choi al een klein mirakel. Ze zijn er eigenlijk altijd van uitgegaan dat hun debuut Pain Olympics ook hun enige plaat ging worden. Maar kijk, er komt dus toch een opvolger en dit zal erop staan. Please Yourself van Crack Cloud.
Washed out down on K Street in the 80s.
Bye. Nee, we nemen nog geen afscheid, maar het is de titel van de nieuwe EP van het zestal Blood uit Philadelphia. Dit nummer, Luck, is het slotnummer daarvan. Echt snelle werkers zijn de gasten van Luna Rosa, niet het kwartet uit de buurt van het Noord-Engelse Northampton, bracht in 2015 een eerste EP uit. Nu, 7 jaar later, komt er zowaar een tweede EP aan. Dit is het titelnummer daarvan, Brutal Nature van Luna Rosa.
My smoke out onto Satan's spiral staircase, and he asked me to leave, so I scurry